Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. As today we talk about the management of myelofibrosis with Dr. Ruben Mesa, the President, Atrium Health, Levine Center Cancer, Executive Director, Atrium Health, Wake Forest Baptist Comprehensive Cancer Center in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. We have a great faculty for this series. Dr. O did the first program. And later on, we're going to show you a survey that we did of the faculty of their usual treatment practices. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room and we'll bring up as many of these as we have time. In the chat room is a one-minute survey for you to take before and after the meeting. If you do that, we think you'll get a lot more out of this experience and we'll learn a little bit about you. Next week, we'll be doing a program with Dr. Van Cutsem on gastroesophageal cancer. Always great to speak with him. And then we'll be continuing our year in review series and now talking about AML with Drs. Daver and DiNardo. We'll get a little MD Anderson flavor there. Then we're heading to Washington. Every year, we go to the ONS meeting to talk to oncology nurses. We're actually doing 10 programs there this year. So if you have any nurses or you're a nurse, in the Washington area, come on over or just check it out online. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including we put in the first program in this series, as I mentioned, with Dr. O. But today, we're so thrilled to talk with Dr. Mesa about myelofibrosis. And as we do with all of these programs, first of all, just a reminder, we will be talking about non-FDA-approved uses of agents, so refer to prescribing information. But as we do in all our Meet the Professor programs, we're going to actually present a number of cases from docs in practice. And I just want to point out that for this series, you know, we have actually two general medical oncologists, Drs. Friemel and Gupta, who, of course, rarely see MF. Ruben, we did an entire weekend for general medical oncologists. I think it was about 10 days ago, like 20 hours, 35 investigators, but we did not have time to talk about myelofibrosis. So it's tough for general medical oncologists to keep up with these less common diseases. But we also have Dr. Battinger, who was actually on the faculty of Ohio State and then went into community practice, but specializes in HEMOC. And finally, Dr. Palmer, who I'm sure you know, is an investigator in the field. So we have kind of a spectrum of cases we're going to present. And I guess just before we get started, I just want to take a breath. You know, Ruben, I was telling you that, you know, we think about a quarter of our audience has been in oncology less than 10 years. And I just want to reflect back to sort of when things change for this disease. You know, you and I did it. The last program we did was a year and a half ago, November 2022. So it'll be interesting to compare what you told me then. Now we've had the approval of another JAK inhibitor, momelotinib, since then, as well as now at the ASH meeting, the two big phase three trials that you were just talking about at that point. But now we have some data on that. So I want to just sort of take a step back and maybe talk a little bit about where things were in 2005. So when I think about 2005, one of the things I remember is in 2004 is when the EGFR mutation was discovered in lung cancer, and that really changed how we thought about targeted therapy in solid tumors. We'd previously seen targeted therapy, of course, with CML, really so dramatic. But, you know, 2005, you were telling me that myelofibrosis is called myeloproliferative disorder. So it wasn't even identified at that point as a leukemia. And then you all discovered the JAK mutation with that kind of going on. So maybe you can just talk a little bit about what it was like to treat a patient, you know, before that time, and then what started to evolve. And then finally, let's tell the audience about a patient you saw today.
Wonderful. Well, Neil, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. I always love our conversations. I think these are really helpful discussions, and I'm sure really helpful for folks who are both watching this or listening to this as a podcast or on their radio as they're driving. Indeed, in myelofibrosis and the myeloproliferative neoplasms, 2005 was a real watershed moment. So, you know, as I think about my career, you know, I've been involved with caring for these patients ever since I was a medical student at the beginning of the 1990s. Having had the chance to be mentored at that point by Ayolu Teferi, who's been a legendary leader in this field. You know, and that first stretch of time before those key driver mutations, JAK2 V617F being the first amongst them. One, with this group of disorders, there was a lot of discussion, you know, are they clonal, are they chronic leukemias? And in depth through a variety of different studies, you know, X chromosome inactivation, they had been proven to be clonal. So again, as one thinks way back, there was always the conversation, are these malignant disorders, are they not? They had been shown to be clonal. But trying to develop therapies for these diseases had largely been around trying to beg, borrow, or steal medicines that were being tested for other indications. And for myelofibrosis, in my career, we were trying anti-scarring drugs or anti-fibrosing drugs that were not very effective. And then we had a lot of work that was done on anti-angiogenesis drugs because we had noticed angiogenesis was increased and went through all the whole the different IMIDs, thalidomide, lenalidomide, etc. But we were largely trying to convince people to let us use their drugs to try to treat this disease of myelofibrosis. So 2005 comes out, and the seminal observation by William Ventschenker and his group that the JAK2 V617F was present in half of patients with myelofibrosis, almost all of patients with polycythemia vera, and again, about half of those with ET. So a really important mutation. And that really led us to really changed everything. One, it gave much greater clarity who has the disease and who doesn't have the disease. Two, it really stimulated the development of therapies specifically for the disease. Now, we had the hope, you're exactly right, if one thinks at that era, we had already had an example, both in heme malignancies from CML, so the BCR-ABL inhibitors of imatinib, in particular at that point, and nilotinib and dasatinib that were being, being tested at that point, that those drugs completely made a transformational impact on CML. And we had gone from more superficial benefit with other things to drugs that led to a complete remission and a deep molecular response. And similarly, in lung cancer, the EGFR mutation, again, being able to inhibit that in patients with the mutation really had a huge impact on the disease. You know, we had evolved from that point of, you know, use a drug and there is a 20% response rate, and you realize that it's because the 20% actually had the target that you were aiming for and the other 80% didn't. So it was really in that context of both drugs being developed as well as then the hope. Now, the hope initially before we even started the JAK inhibitor. So there was a delta of 2005 was when the JAK2 V617F was discovered. And it was 2007 when we did the first phase 1 trial of ruxolitinib. And one of the reasons that time was short is that there was already a JAK inhibitor program, both at Incyte, which was an offshoot of DuPont at that point, as well as a couple other companies that, again, had been speculating that the JAK-STAT pathway was going to be relevant both in malignant disease but also in inflammatory and autoimmune diseases. So and that has proven to be the case. And that as we started those trials, we again had a hope before we started them that by giving a patient a JAK inhibitor, the disease would completely go away, like it occurred with CML. And as we'll get into our conversation today, we've learned that that benefit is more nuanced, that there was clear benefit, rapid improvement in how people felt, which was meaningful, rapid reduction in the size of the spleen. Now, what we've learned over time that's really relevant is that there's an additional benefit from JAK inhibition, which is probably an impact on progression-free survival. And in some of the best responders, really quite significant. So ironically, today I saw a patient as a new consult who had been diagnosed with myelofibrosis in his 30s, prior to 2011. I think he was diagnosed in 2007. But in 2011, started on ruxolitinib, had a response, and as of today, still on ruxolitinib. So well over 13 years later, without transfusions, without significant impact from the disease. Now, his spleen is enlarged, and at this point, it's a consideration of adjusting his therapy. But this is an individual who, based on our old prognostic scores, we would have expected to have passed away from the disease many years ago. And this individual is not alone. There are many others that kind of fall in this category. So it's really been a significant impact that falls perhaps short of that imatinib-type miracle, but very impactful.
So I want to kind of fast forward to where we are today, particularly as it relates to JAK inhibitors, because as we mentioned, now we've got four that are approved. I'm just going to show a few of the papers that we put in the slide set for people to check out and read that go through a lot of things we're talking about, mechanism of action of the JAK inhibitors. Also, there's a great paper comparing the JAK inhibitors in terms of their targets. Paper looking at ACVR1 that I want you to explain to me. This one was paconitinib, but I know it's an issue beyond that. Here's some more, sort of MOA data slides to sort of give some of the ideas about how these drugs work. But this is what I really want to focus on. I would like you to explain to me, or us, not only in terms of treatment of myelofibrosis, but also, as we saw at ASH, seems to be potentially related to treatment of polycythemia vera, where we saw that this hepcidin mimetic rusfertide in the REVIVE study seemed to do it. Patients had a lot fewer transfusion. There's a phase 3 trial. But what I want to do is kind of looking at these two approaches to this sort of model. Can you kind of go through the model and how it relates to myelofibrosis and MPNs in general?
Sure. So this slide here really relates to hepcidin regulation, and the impact really on hepcidin for iron absorption and release. And you could think, if there's more hepcidin, it leans more toward the side of inflammation and less iron absorption, and can be very much aligned with like anemia of chronic disease. Likewise, if hepcidin is decreased, that can be lead to less iron absorption, can lead to a decrease in red blood cells. So this is not the pathologic state. This is kind of the normal activity with you see there in the red, the impact of JAK inhibition. So there are really kind of two sides of the same coin. So first, let's start with the JAK inhibitor piece. So we now have four approved JAK inhibitors: ruxolitinib, fedratinib, momelotinib, and pacritinib. And as we get through today's discussion, they all inhibit JAK2. And they all are inhibitors of the JAK-STAT pathway. They're not specific for JAK2 V617F. And that part is important. There are three driver mutations. The JAK2 V617F, which I had mentioned earlier, is present in about half of patients with myelofibrosis. There's calreticulin that's present in about a third of patients with myelofibrosis. There is MPL that's present maybe in about 5% of patients with myelofibrosis. But all of them impact the JAK-STAT pathway in different ways and lead it to be constitutively active, so it's always on. And we know that individuals that, even if they lack any of those three mutations, still have an overactivated JAK-STAT pathway. So that pathway being overly turned on is important, and inhibiting it likewise is important and beneficial. This is important because it's different than imatinib in CML. So in imatinib in CML, you have a molecule that's inhibiting only the mutant form. Because BCR and ABL come together only in its mutant form in those cells. Where the JAK2 V617F, it's a point mutation, but the medicines are not specific to the mutant form. So it's shutting down, it's decreasing JAK2 in all of the cells, and then having the both the benefit but also some of the toxicity that comes from JAK inhibition is because of that lack of specificity that can lead to a drop in red blood cells or a drop in the platelets. Now, I mentioned that we have four drugs. And what we've learned from why there are four drugs is because they all have slightly different profiles. And in particular, there are two that have differing impacts on both anemia and or thrombocytopenia, momelotinib for anemia, pacritinib for thrombocytopenia and anemia, in part because of some of their non-JAK2 impact. They hit other kinases and they hit other pieces. So, for example, both momelotinib and pacritinib are inhibitors of ACVR1. Where that leads to on this diagram is it leads to a decrease in hepcidin. In myelofibrosis as a normal state, hepcidin is increased. It creates an anemia of chronic disease type situation, and it leads to anemia. So if you inhibit hepcidin, it decreases hepcidin. It improves anemia. What you showed from the prior slide in polycythemia vera, the challenge is really the opposite. There are too many red blood cells, and our therapies, whether they're medicines or phlebotomy, are basically aimed at decreasing the number of red blood cells. So this is the flip side. So this study here presented by Ellen Ritchie with the medicine resveratide, this here mimics hepcidin. So it increases hepcidin, and then it creates a state of, again, of pseudo anemia of chronic disease. So it decreases the number of red blood cells. So this is like a medication equivalent of a phlebotomy. So that one, it helps people get into a safer range for their number of red blood cells. But two, the benefit is that they can decrease the red blood cells without then being iron deficient. And that is beneficial because iron deficiency can lead to fatigue or symptoms and sometimes can really aggravate the baseline symptoms that patients with P-Vera can have, as well as have a more steady control of the red blood cells. So I view these as kind of they both really help to prove the point in that if you increase hepcidin, it decreases the number of red blood cells. If you decrease hepcidin, it increases it. So in myelofibrosis, decreasing it is helpful, and we're decreasing it through inhibiting ACVR1. If we give hepcidin, as we do with resveratide, less red blood cells, and it helps to curb too many red blood cells in the setting of PV.
So let me ask you a simple question. Maybe it's a naive question, but I think I hear this from oncologists. So it's really great that we have pacritinib for patients with thrombocytopenia, again, label 50,000, but then and also momelotinib now for anemia. But do we know, have they been compared, in, for example, has pacritinib been compared to ruxolitinib in patients without thrombocytopenia? And particularly long-term, or momelotinib, has it been compared to patients without anemia? I know in the trial in patients with anemia, it looked like it was similar, but what about patients without cytopenias? Do we know whether or not these drugs would be better in the long run?
Yes. So with momelotinib, there was a phase 3 study called the Simplify 1 study that was in treatment naive, momelotinib versus ruxolitinib. They were equivalent for the reduction of splenomegaly. momelotinib in that analysis was slightly inferior as it related to improvement in symptoms. We've done some subsequent analysis after that point that suggests that it's probably closer to really being non-inferior. So probably relatively equivalent for those first two endpoints. And that there was then a difference as it related to those patients who were anemic. But the eligibility was not limited to those with anemia. We subsequently have had trials that were second line that focused solely on patients with anemia. With pacritinib, we do not have head-to-head data as it relates to those individuals without thrombocytopenia, although we do have head-to-head in the PERSIST-2 study where patients could be on best alternative therapy versus pacritinib, and some were on ruxolitinib. We do know that pacritinib still is beneficial in individuals even without thrombocytopenia. So there was the PERSIST-1 study, of which I had been the principal investigator, that was the original randomized trial of pacritinib versus best alternative therapy. And in that study, showed compared to BAT, pacritinib was superior for control of spleen and symptoms, but was a trial done several years ago, so it was not it did not have a direct ruxolitinib comparator.
So a couple other questions in terms of long-term follow-up with ruxolitinib, and also related to your patient who got treated for so long. Weight gain, non-melanoma skin cancers, and viral infections, including herpes. What do we know about this and people on ruxolitinib, and did your patient have either any of those problems?
So a very good question. So one, I'd say you really hit the nail on the head on the three things that I really do counsel my patients regarding potential toxicities with this. So one, ruxolitinib clearly can lead to weight gain. It clearly stabilizes. Part of that is because the hypermetabolic state that normally is present in the disease is gone. So people are used to eating more and they gain some weight. It may be more than that just because of some of the impact it has on leptin and some other factors. Two, the increase in non-melanoma skin cancers is real. I have patients certainly following with dermatologists, but that's a toxicity we really do need to watch for. There's a small subset of people in which that can really be a limiter that needs to move on to different therapy. Where, and again, it's a small number, but it is real, where they have, you know, multiple non-melanoma skin cancers, sometimes even aggressive. And that can be a deal killer in terms of therapy. And the final one is really around herpes zoster. I typically counsel for patients to receive the inactivated vaccine to really try to decrease that from coming on. There have been patients that have recurring zoster. And again, that too can be a limiter. Fortunately, this individual has had non-melanoma squamous cell that was removed with Mohs, but really only had one, but is a younger patient, so I have to, you know, at least consider it as likely related. But the other two had not been a factor. So overall, really had tolerated it pretty well.
I'm just kind of curious, these seeming sort of unusual issues, you know, weight gain, non-melanoma skin cancer, do you see those with the other JAK inhibitors?
Certainly, ruxolitinib has both the advantage but also wears the burden of having been the only approved therapy from basically 2011 to almost 2020, because fedratinib was approved in the fall of 2019. So almost a decade of really being the only therapy. So the long-term experience with ruxolitinib really is just dramatically more enriched than for the other medications. I think all of those are theoretically possible. Some are more tied to the inhibition of JAK1 than solely being with the JAK2. We've not seen as much of those three things in the other ones yet, but I do think that time can be a factor.
All right, so do you want to make some rounds?
Yes,
absolutely.
We'll
be rocket
absolutely.
Rounds. We're going to do like 7 or 8 cases. We'll see if we can just sort of crack through them and get a little bit of a picture of how this all plays out in the real world, so to speak. So first, Dr. Battinger has an interesting case. This is an 85-year-old lady who presented with myelofibrosis in 1999 in a very unusual way. And I'm curious whether you've seen this presentation.
The main reason I picked this 85-year-old woman is because I had never seen anybody diagnosed with myelofibrosis in this manner. But this patient is 85 years old, and she was actually diagnosed in myelofibrosis in 1999 after she had a routine screening mammogram that showed a left breast mass. And obviously, everybody thought that was breast cancer, but when it was biopsied, it actually resulted as bone marrow tissue. And so,
wow.
Yeah, I had not seen anything like that. And so she ultimately had a diagnostic bone marrow biopsy and aspirate, which showed that she had primary myelofibrosis, but her blood counts were not significantly impaired and she felt well. So for 10 years after her diagnosis, she was just managed expectantly.
And then I'll just add to that that she actually, after 2014, progressed, and she actually died of myelofibrosis after being, you know, not treated for over 10 years. So any thoughts about the case? Have you seen this presentation?
So not in the breast, but without question, MF can present with extramedullary hematopoiesis. You know, and certainly the spleen is the most common location for extramedullary hematopoiesis, which is why we, again, a common presentation is someone has incidentally notes an enlarged spleen, but it has presented as a mass or an organ mass. It has presented certainly with spinal cord compression or in the spine or in the lungs or with ascites or pleural fluid. Not common. Things we have noted is one, when it does have a mass-like presentation, it tends to be exquisitely sensitive to radiation. You know, so again, if it's in a problematic spot, sometimes we give radiation for these individuals. It's good that they were thoughtful as well as did a biopsy and really were able to go down kind of the correct pathway. Because certainly you can imagine the risk of someone assuming that it's something else and being really, you know, very incorrect in terms of what the disease is.
What about the lag time between, you know, that she was observed for so long without, and then progressed and died?
It's a disease that really has a fascinating heterogeneity in terms of the natural history. But I think as Dr. But Nagar was saying, you know, her counts were relatively normal around the time of presentation and was otherwise relatively asymptomatic. So a fascinating presentation, but the mass aside, had a relatively benign presentation that would have suggested somewhat latent disease. Now, I do wonder with this individual who again ended up then having latent disease but then progressing, you know, as we have found in other hematologic malignancies, sometimes extramural presentations sometimes can come back to bite you in terms of aggressiveness. And again, I wonder whether that, although it was latent but then passed away, you know, whether there may have been some link with that. You know, just as we sometimes see an extramedullary hematopoietic presentation of AML with like a myeloid sarcoma, you know, sometimes can have, you know, very difficult behavior.
So this next case brings up one of the most common questions I hear from oncologists. In fact, two docs in the chat room have similar cases. Dr. Kumar has a 59-year-old patient, and Dr. Ghazal has a 45-year-old patient. For both of the cases, they want to know, should they treat or not, which is the same question Dr. Freemel has. Here's her case.
He was referred to me for elevated white count and platelet count. We eventually did further evaluation of the bone marrow biopsy, and the final pathology showed primary myelofibrosis was favored, less than 1% blasts. And he was feeling pretty well. I mean, he had some intentional weight loss, but no constitutional symptoms. He had a good support system. You know, he just had the abnormal lab test, basically. Since he was asymptomatic, we actually discussed just observation until he developed either symptomatic splenomegaly, or he didn't have any hepatosplenomegaly on exam, or constitutional symptoms or something else. We gave him information, and he and his family were kind of in agreement with that plan. And then if he were to develop anemia, we would institute the ESA therapy, splenomegaly without anemia, probably hydroxyurea, splenomegaly with anemia, sort of my thought process there, then JAK2 inhibitor.
So what are the questions you have about this case?
Well, I guess the first question is, did I do the right decision? I mean, would any providers have started any specific myelofibrosis treatment or medication for cytoreduction in this patient rather than just initial observation? And then second, let's say this patient was a higher risk on the DIPSS plus risk score. Would recommendations change in that situation?
So, yeah, this patient was low risk and also had a JAK2 mutation. And she mentioned the looking at the prognostic score, which system do you use? And what about the general question of when to start therapy? Another issue, we were talking before about, you know, how when this initially started, I think a lot of people were expecting you needed the JAK mutation in order to benefit from JAK inhibitors. That was a misconception that was out there for a while. But really, with the pathophysiology you described, it's kind of obvious. So again, very common question from our oncologists. You have a low-risk patient without cytopenias. When do you start treatment, and how do you decide which one?
Well, with this individual, so one, you know, which risk score to use? There are multiple of them. I think in the patient that is potentially of a bone marrow transplantable age, I now think that it's clearly our standard of care to consider obtaining a myeloid genetic panel. They're readily available. They can be done on the peripheral blood. You know, they're in the NCCN guidelines, so should be able to be reimbursed. Now, this has evolved over time. You know, 5 years ago, some of these may not have been reimbursed, etc. But over time, we found that it really is really quite prognostic, and that helps to refine that risk. Is it really as low risk as it seems? But as Dr. Freemel mentioned, certainly low-risk asymptomatic observation certainly is a consideration. Now, the other consideration in this group is, again, in many ways we have found that the patient that she was describing is someone who in the past we may have labeled as having essential thrombocythemia. And it does overlap with that sort of presentation. High platelet count. They're 73, and again, we think less in terms of the impact of myelofibrosis. Myelofibrosis, you're thinking spleen, symptoms, risk of mortality. If we were to say he's a 73-year-old with ET, they'd say, well, you know, the elevation in the platelets and the white blood cell count, they have a risk of blood clots. Should they be on hydroxyurea or another medicine to prevent progression? In this group, we sometimes will consider medicines for controlling the platelet count around the risk of thrombosis, as well as there's increasing evidence that the use of long-acting interferons, like pegylated interferon alpha 2A, may have a benefit in helping to decrease the likelihood of progressing into much more overt myelofibrosis. And there have been studies done and there was one presented at ASH this last December, showing in young patients with ET treated with interferon versus hydroxyurea, they seem to have a very significant decrease in progression-free survival compared to hydroxyurea. So less myelofibrosis issues, but more issues around should they be on nothing. And I think there's a case to be made for a 73-year-old to consider cytoreduction, but for different goals than we have with MF, to decrease the risk of thrombosis, but maybe also to decrease progression. All of that said, low-risk asymptomatic by our NCCN guidelines, still that is a consideration.
So next case from Dr. Palmer is an 80-year-old woman with pancytopenia and a primary MF. Hear her questions.
80-year-old female presents with pancytopenia, weight loss, early satiety, and fatigue. Her hemoglobin is 7.2, white blood cell count 2.9, normal differential, platelets of 38. Her spleen is palpable at about 7 centimeters below the left costal margin. Her MPN-TSS is 15 based on fatigue, early satiety, and inactivity. A bone marrow biopsy is hypocellular with abnormal megakaryocytes, no increase in blasts. And in this picture, you see the large hypolobated megakaryocytes as well as a bone marrow reticulin stain that shows extensive fibrosis. And so how would you treat this patient? Would this be somebody that you would consider pacdoritinib for, momelotinib for, based on their anemia? How closely would you monitor this patient once you had started them on this medication? How do you differentiate when you're thinking of patients who have the myelofibrosis that has these very high white blood cell counts and big spleen and lots of symptoms versus somebody like this patient who just has a real significant pancytopenia?
Any thoughts?
Well, we clearly have learned over time that there's different kind of subgroups of patients with myelofibrosis. And I think as Dr. Palmer is describing, this is someone that we have really would have cytopenic myelofibrosis. The counts are low. The spleen is not that big. We've learned over time these patients are frequently less likely to have the JAK2 mutation. They frequently are either triple negative or at least don't have the JAK2 mutation. And they clearly still can benefit from therapy. You know, this would be an individual who one could make a case for either pacritinib or momelotinib. Both would be fair. I think with the platelets of 38, I might start with pacritinib. That would be very reasonable. It certainly is on-label pacritinib for patients with a platelet count of less than 50,000. That ability to inhibit ACVR1 may help to improve the anemia. Momelotinib also could be considered. We certainly have tested it in individuals with a platelet count of greater than 25,000 and can help with anemia. If they were transfusion dependent, that would have, I think, swing the pendulum more toward the momelotinib side, but they clearly overlap for an individual like this. And again, I would give the medication, 3 to 6 months to really see an impact. And then if did not have the impact I wanted, then I would switch to the other one. Or clearly if there was, a lack of benefit or toxicity from one prior to that, then I would switch to the other one.
So I was just fantasizing if you could do a trial of patients just like this patient, like 200 patients or something, and you compared ruxolitinib to momelotinib to pacritinib. Obviously, it'll never happen, but just kind of curious, what do you think it would show? And what do you think you would do in this situation?
Well, I think, momelotinib and pacritinib, I think, would clearly distinguish themselves as being better than ruxolitinib in a three-arm study. And the limiter with ruxolitinib is that we have to end up dose reducing, and we typically really have not an effective dose kind of between them. I think that we'd see, benefit to both momelotinib and pacritinib. Whether we would see statistical superiority from one versus the other, it's tough to say. I think I would pick pacritinib first, but I think it's a relatively even choice, particularly for this individual. If the platelets were even lower, let's say the platelets were 12, they'd clearly be pacritinib. Let's say the platelets were 110 and anemic, then I would be thinking much more of the momelotinib side of the coin.
What about 50,000 to 100,000? How do you, in general, not so much this case, but let's say somebody who's not anemic, but thrombocytopenic, 70, 80, 90,000. Pacritinib or ruxolitinib?
Well, I think if they're that way, really, without any therapy, I certainly will be considering pacritinib. you know, and the lower, I think, the stronger the case. In the PERSIST-2 study, we clearly had individuals as frontline who received pacritinib and really both had safety and efficacy. So that in the NCCN guidelines, it has the strongest backing for under 50, but 50 to 100, it's still a real consideration. Again, with the limiter being that we can use ruxolitinib, we have to start it low, we have to march up the dose. But there are many patients, you know, in the U.S., and it'd be the risk for this individual, that are on ruxolitinib, but really a subtherapeutic dose. What we've learned over time is that being on a subtherapeutic dose really limits the impact. It still is probably better than nothing. So over time, we found that with most patients with MF that need therapy, being on a JAK inhibitor is better than being on nothing, even if the impact has been modest. But being on an effective dose of a JAK inhibitor is really the goal.
So that comes to maybe the number two question from docs in the community, which is you start a patient with reasonable counts on ruxolitinib, and then they become thrombocytopenic, anemic. Do you dose reduce or switch to pacritinib or momelotinib?
I think at this point in time, now that we have more therapies, I think I would consider a switch. You know, in the past, we used to ride out the dose to the best degree that we could. You know, but now in the era of alternative medications, you know, we know that probably the earlier an individual has a meaningful response, the better off they are. We know a bit of this from the comfort studies. You know, patients who were initially on effective ruxolitinib versus placebo, that even though the difference in crossover was just, you know, 6 months, that led to a real difference in survival. So I would say, you know, the longer a patient is not receiving effective therapy, that is a negative. So I think trying to get to an effective medicine sooner rather than later has benefit for the patient.
Well, that's why I was asking about, you know, the idea of looking at a trial like a pacritinib in people who start out that are not thrombocytopenic, because maybe, you know, you have a lot of people who are going to get dose reduced and, you know, maybe they don't have as much activity. I don't know. I just was thinking there what would be interesting. Let's take one more case, and then I want to talk to you about what happened at ASH, because, again, I'm hearing a lot of questions and things come up about this. This is another general medical oncologist, Dr. Ranju Gupta, 73-year-old man with a lot of medical comorbidities, long, long list, including active heart failure. Here's the case.
This is a guy who is 73 years old, morbidly obese with lots of issues, diabetes, hypertension, congestive heart failure, not well controlled, diagnosed with myelofibrosis, with anemia, required blood transfusion, splenomegaly on ultrasound. I started him on ruxolitinib, 15 milligram twice a day. He did well. His transfusion demand came down. He had an admission with GI bleeding, after which he had some thrombocytopenia. So I had to reduce him to 10 milligram twice a day. And, you know, because of his other medical issues, we never went up. And then over time, he has developed a lot of leukocytosis. His WBC count has gone up to 25,000 with, you know, left shift myelocytes, metamyelocytes, the usual myelofibrosis part. Flow cytometry shows that it is still myelofibrosis, nothing else going on. So my question here is that what would be the next treatment? Should we just increase the dose of ruxolitinib to 20 BID, the full dose? This is a guy who has decompensated congestive heart failure fluid overload. So would there be a better choice for him?
Actually, I was thinking, I talked to her before momelotinib was approved, incidentally, but any thoughts about the case?
Well, I think momelotinib actually it would be the therapy of choice. You know, so one, anemia clearly is a negative for this individual. It's limiting the dose, and clearly it can impact the congestive heart failure. Pacritinib in earlier studies had some concerns regarding individuals with cardiovascular comorbidities. Always difficult to know how real that genuinely is because, again, they had a higher risk group of individuals with cytopenias and risk of potential complications. But all things put together, I think that individual were in the ideal world, you'd have an improvement in anemia as well as being able to give the medicine at full dose. I think momelotinib would be the choice for that individual.
Incidentally, quick question from the chat room. Does pacritinib actually increase the platelet count or just prevent it from dropping down?
That's a very good question. It can increase the platelet count, but its main value is that it doesn't lower it further and that you then don't have bleeding complications. There have been certainly some, but it is a modest percentage that because of reduction in the splenomegaly, you see the platelet count actually increase. But when it comes to an increase in low counts, that's where we see really the real benefit from momelotinib as it relates to anemia. Momelotinib can really improve anemia. Pacritinib, it's really around safety, being able to use it in patients with existing thrombocytopenia.
Interesting. Well, let's chat a little bit about ASH. As I mentioned, you know, a lot of people are asking about, particularly those two phase three studies that were presented. We actually did a program with Dr. Pemaraja, just on what happened at ASH. It goes through a lot of these papers and many that we're not going to. Here's the program that we did. So Transform, we're talking about navitoclax, I guess a cousin to venetoclax. This study, I guess, we're not going to go through all the data, but the bottom line was it looked like it had a significant effect on the spleen, but not symptoms. What's the thinking, the pathobiology of why this drug works? Why is it different than venetoclax in terms of its target? And what do you think about this study and the future of this strategy?
So one, it's a BCL-XL inhibitor, and that's involved with apoptosis. And actually, I had an NCI grant at the beginning of my career, a K award, when I was in the laboratory of Dr. Scott Kaufman, who had come to Mayo from Johns Hopkins, looking at apoptotic resistance. So actually, looking back, this is before the discovery of the JAK2 mutation. We had noticed that there was apoptotic resistance in the cells, and that there was this resistance that potentially could be leveraged. Navitoclax has a slightly different mechanism of action of venetoclax in that it's working for BCL XL, as well as it was preclinical models that suggested that it may have some benefit over venetoclax. It might be stronger, lead to more cytopenias or things of that nature. You know, and in earlier studies had shown benefit when added on to JAK inhibition for patients with myelofibrosis. What was seen in the study was, one, a significant increase in reduction of splenomegaly compared to ruxolitinib alone. And then, two, at least equivalent reduction in symptoms to ruxolitinib alone. Now, when one considers symptoms, you know, one, you see benefit. So there was benefit. It just wasn't better than ruxolitinib. Now, of course, there's a trade-off there because, of course, you have two drugs. Two drugs may have more low-grade side effects. So it still balanced it out. So you might think that there's a little bit of a toxicity cost to being on two medicines and that some of the benefit from the medicine may have offset that. So it was not inferior to being on ruxolitinib for improvement in symptoms. The trial had been designed in the hopes of seeing that both were better, although we don't really know whether that was really a realistic hope. There also can be a little bit of a ceiling effect as it relates to improvement in symptoms, particularly in a frontline study. In a frontline study, they may be a little less symptomatic. And it's different than the era of the COMFORT studies. You know, the initial studies we did in JAK inhibitors, you know, we didn't have approved therapies. There weren't JAK inhibitors. Patients had sometimes long-standing disease. They had really difficult disease. They had massive spleens. Now people get treated much closer to the time of diagnosis because we have so many other therapies, you know. So, you know, not really sure that it was really even a fair expectation to think that you could show a statistical superiority in symptoms in addition to splenomegaly in an upfront study.
So when you think about it, are there situations right now, of course, as you say, you've got to consider the downside, the cost, et cetera. Any situations right now where you think you might want to use this strategy either upfront or maybe in a patient progressing on ruxolitinib?
Well, I think in patients progressing, without question, you know, I think both this as well as pelabresib, you know, made a strong case from their phase 3 study in that in many ways they were kind of parallel trials, different mechanism of action, impacting, it's a BET inhibitor, but both had almost double the response rate for splenomegaly. And neither showed clear superiority for a change in symptoms. A little bit difficult to really compare them head to head because they were really parallel studies. But both really have this significant incremental benefit. So without question, tomorrow, if we had both drugs available, adding them on to patients that had a suboptimal response for splenomegaly would be a natural. I mean, the patient who I saw today, as I had mentioned, has a big spleen, clearly needs something different, is not overly cytopenic, and again, you know, adding another agent on would be, you know, the most attractive to really try to gain additional benefit for such an individual. Now, in individuals that are JAK inhibitor naive, I think, again, both make a case for, you know, all things being equal, potentially being able to benefit from being on combination therapy. You know, I think we'll find over time, you know, if there's an FDA approval, you know, is there, does the FDA put in some prerequisite? Do we consider it in individuals who are higher risk or have a certain molecular phenotype? You know, the data we have from the phase 3 trials did not yet include kind of subset type analysis to really suggest, is there one group that benefits over the other that, in terms of the expense or other pieces? But there's clearly stronger data, you know, and we have seen that, you know, the reduction in splenomegaly from the JAK inhibitor studies was associated with the improvement in survival, and that a much more profound decrease in splenomegaly may be predictive of longer-term benefit, longer-term survival. Now, we've not fully proven that yet, but certainly there's, you know, certainly the hope that that is predictive, and I think that will be end up being a driver of the benefit in combinations. You know, you had shown there the slide with selinexor. You know, you could think that there's now a whole range of different drugs with different mechanisms of action, naftamadlin, selinexor, imidostat, amongst others, that like pelabresib and navitoclax clearly have a different mechanism of action to JAK2 inhibitors, most of which are showing benefit of potentially consideration, you know, along with a JAK inhibitor to augment benefit in people who are suboptimal responders or potentially in combination. So I think, you know, we're walking the path that I think has been clearly seen in other heme malignancies, you know, likely of multi-drug therapy to try to impact a more than one pathway and to try to better impact the disease.
So I want to get to the survey of the faculty, but a couple more papers I just want to ask you about. I know you've done so much work on pactinib. There were a couple of papers at ASH in terms of symptom benefit, transfusion response with pacρtinib. Also, cytopenic myelofibrosis, looking back at PERSIST-2 and PAC-203. Any comments about these data sets?
Well, one we have found, I think, with a range of these different analyses, one, improving transfusions matter. It has an impact on functionality and probably has impact on survival, as well as, again, the benefit, the safety of using pacritinib in individuals with low platelets, but also that there can be a platelet response that kind of corresponds along with that. So I view kind of those as kind of a suite of additional analyses and studies that continue to show that these impacts in terms of cytopenias that both of these agents have are meaningful. They have a meaning likely in terms of survival. They have a meaning in terms of symptoms. They have a meaning that improvement in symptoms may improve not only quality of life, but really functionality, you know, as measured by different indirect measures of kind of function and activities of daily living.
So let's take a look at a couple of those questions we asked the faculty. A few case scenarios: 65-year-old patient, higher risk, symptomatic disease, didn't really get a good response to ruxolitinib at the standard dose. Counts were still okay. We asked people what they would do, and there's a kind of a mix. You say escalate the dose. Several people say that. This is how we do consensus. If people say two different things, that's not a consensus. Other people say switch to fedratinib. Any thoughts?
Well, I would say, you know, after 3 months, I might still consider trying to further increase the dose. I'd say if it had been 6 months and you had really achieved, you know, a dose of 15 or 20 milligrams twice a day, and the counts are normal, then most certainly fedratinib clearly would have been, or clearly would be the choice. Fedratinib is a solid, you know, 30-35% response rate in the second line setting. It really is underutilized as second line setting in the U.S. So certainly that's a strong consideration. But if it's only been 3 months, I might give it a while longer.
So here's another scenario: younger patient, 55 years old, presents with a big spleen and a lot of symptoms and a platelet count of 44,000. But with this age, everybody says transplant, which we've had several people in the chat room asking about it. So first, can you comment about how you might think this case through, and also in general, how you think through the issue of transplant and myelofibrosis?
Although I think very much like the case before, one could make the case for momelotinib in this setting as well, but I think pacritinib would probably be the choice. But it shows you that it's a good teaching moment that even I, as I blew over this part, again, good to get all the facts. And I think in terms of what are the labs that really drive decisions between these medicines, the platelet count and the degree of anemia are really important considerations. You know, this is an individual I clearly fear the long-term piece. So I do think that this individual is moving toward a transplant, and it's a question of how do we try to get a better response in the interim with a JAK inhibitor, because I think the mutations show a higher risk profile, and clearly they're only 55 years of age. So I think in this situation, try to get the best impact we can from a JAK inhibitor, pacritinib or momelotinib, and then the transplant.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is another therapy that I was not aware of in terms of myelofibrosis, a very interesting one in particular, Mediterranean diet intervention that you guys looked at. And I really encourage everybody to check out the reference. We won't go into all the details. Bottom line is, I think everybody knows Mediterranean diet, more plant-based, not much fat, no meat, etc. You actually saw a benefit for symptoms. Is this a strategy that you use with your patients?
Without question. So one, tremendous kudos to my colleague, Dr. Angela Fleischman, who brings, I think, a lot of scientific rigor to trying to decrease inflammation both through diet and other interventions with these patients. You know, what we've learned is a chronic disease that if patients are eating poorly, they don't sleep well, and they're inactive, we clearly are going to have a hard time making them feel better. And I think what this trial showed, that if you take individuals who really have an unstructured or an unhealthy diet and they follow the recommendations of a Mediterranean diet that both has an impact in terms of composition that is less inflammatory, but also probably in terms of volumes and degrees of calories. One, they can clearly have a benefit, and two, they clearly can feel better. So it's an important piece. You know, I frequently will tell patients, I probably cannot prescribe your way to feeling better solely with medications.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, whether this diet would work in other, you know, inflammatory situations. Other thing I loved about that is that you all did two studies. The first with live, you know, dietitians, and then you did it online and saw the same benefit, which I thought was really great.
Yeah, no, so, without question, can be very helpful.
So, Ruben, as always, it was so great to work with you today. I think everyone learned so much. Audience, thank you for attending. Coming back next week, I'm really looking forward to see what Dr. Van Cutsem has to say. You know, he did the TOGA trial. I want to see what he has to say about TDXD and gastroesophageal cancers. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Ruben.